Welcome to The Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing this fine afternoon?
I'm good, and yourself?
Very well, thank you. And Mr. Gabriel Krauser, who is, I believe, still in the Free State on the farm. Gabriel, how are you?
Good. I just saved my laptop charger from being eaten by a sheep, so feeling very brisk.
And I think that's the best part of you being on the farm is we always get updates on the various doings of livestock and dogs and things. That's great. Anyway, let's get stuck into the stories of today. The first one is that old beast, the SABC. There has been much talk recently of retrenchments at the SABC as it is in a poor financial state in a lot of ways owing to the leadership of Claudia Motsoeneng, who was a former head of the SABC, who did many interesting things like hiring a choir to sing his own praises with SABC money. Anyway, so SABC staffers yesterday said that they were on a go slow while addressing their concerns over the Section 189 notices of retrenchment. The institution is planning to lay off about 400 workers, and there are 170 positions that they can reapply for. So basically, you know, sort of 230-ish people being fired. Workers at SABC's Auckland Park building have been picketing since the end of since the start of this week. There's been a viral video of one of them confronting management and saying that it was unfair and it was cruel to do this to people before Christmas. The protesters have called for management to step down, and here's how the finances are doing. The SABC reported a net loss of 511 million rand for the financial year ending in March. So, Gabriel, there's been a bit of back and forth on this, hasn't there? It's not really clear exactly what the SABC management is going to do here. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is right. So they had put these retrenchments on the table. Then the go slow was put in place. The viral video went around. Then there was a report of the management saying, well, we've taken the retrenchment idea off the table. Everyone will get to keep their jobs. Then obviously someone else in management looked at the balance sheet and said, what are you talking about? And so they've said, well, actually, we're considering the retrenchments again. And so the staff threatened full strike to sort of ramp up from the go slow. Confused messaging for sure, and that coming from our national broadcaster. I like that you called it that old giant. The Institute of Race Relations offices, which are now shutting down to keep us alive virtually, were right close to the SABC's main building in Auckland Park in the center of Johannesburg. And I remember looking up on it a few times, sort of after work, stealing a cigarette in the parking lot. And once encountering our CEO, Frans Krenier, who looked on it as in similar terms, as a giant, but not a sort of ogre or a monster. I think if one looks at countries with properly pernicious, malicious, state-controlled media, you see a very different picture to what comes out of the SABC. In fact, that time that I was having that conversation with France, the SABC had just done an interview with me for quite an extensive period on a live broadcast on their main channel during prime time to talk about BEE. And the host of the debate was critical of BEE. My fellow panelist was fairly critical of BEE, as was I. There were disagreements between us, but that kind of serious reflection upon a failed policy that remains official government policy is not altogether standard In fact, it's completely abnormal in malicious state-owned media. The SABC is often attacked, and it often deserves the criticism that it gets. It makes many mistakes. But I think overall, one should bear in mind that the staff are different to the management. I've heard no one complain so vehemently about Claudia Mutsuning as SABC staff in the sort of makeup room and in studio. They most of them were very happy to see him go. And I think it just speaks to a bit of a tragedy of mismanagement, something that South Africans don't always appreciate, in part because it behooves our politicians to keep this fact obscured. When companies fail, like SAA, like SABC, like Eskom, like Denel, the list goes on. When companies fail to add value, or when whatever little value they add is heavily outweighed by the new debts that they incur, this is not because all of the staff are sitting on their hands and doing nothing. There are often thousands, hundreds or thousands, depending on the size of the company, of people who really are dedicated to their business, to their industry, who want to be excellent and who've gravitated towards state-owned enterprises precisely because they are the most powerful and therefore offer the most opportunity to imprint one's own efforts into society. And many of those efforts are in good faith and many of them are good efforts. But with bad management, the best workers are turned into broken tools that through their best efforts, despite their best efforts, end up being part of a system that drains the poor, broken fiscus of this country even further. And it's a crisis. And that's the crisis that the SABC stands in, is that there's good workers under such previously bad management that they're in a hole that they are unlikely to be able to dig themselves out of without cutting some staff and without making other changes. I think it's a very difficult position. I think it'll be interesting to see what effect the strike has and what kind of sympathy it can garner, because of course other news channels will bear the responsibility of covering it. And I wonder how often we're very sympathetic. Often our South African news is very sympathetic towards strikers. I wonder if that'll hold for the SABC even more so because of a sort of journalistic sense of camaraderie. That being said, it's a when you're working for a state-owned enterprise, it's a there's a sense of national duty which should come to bear. So, in conclusion, it's a mess. It's a damned mess.
Terence, do you agree with Gabriel's assessment of the SABC, and what do you think should be done perhaps to fix it?
Yeah, in broad brushstrokes, certainly. I think Gabriel covered all the bases. I was just reflecting on this, that when I grew up, and I'm dating myself again, in the 1980s, almost all households would tune into the SABC broadcast, and of course, the news coverage was slanted and whatever. All of that is true, but it was the game in town if you had a TV. Then MNET came along sort of mid-80s. I lived in a town actually which didn't have MNET reception, so TV viewing for my entire school life was the SABC. Mm-hmm. Now, things have changed. There are so many different options. At one stage, the SABC ran a licensing campaign where they said, well, even if you don't watch SABC or you only watch MNET, you're still obliged to pay. I mean, these days, your state broadcaster is just one option amongst many, and it has to adapt and change to reflect this. Certainly, there's been huge bad management issues. There has been the censoring of voices. I personally, though, retain some affection for the institution. It is, particularly its radio broadcasts are a major source of news and entertainment for millions and millions of people. If you don't have the sort of uncapped data to stream your entertainment in, the SABC still performs a function there, and it also had a very big role in commissioning and supporting arts and artists in South Africa. But I really don't know how they how we get out of this. You know, it's not the SABC in isolation. It's airline. It's ESCOM, and things have to be accorded some sort of priority. Which I'm not sure the extent to which that is really crystallized with the powers that be. Ultimately, you know, I suppose that what the SABC would need to do is to actually offer a competitive service that people are willing, in effect, to pay for through license fees. But if it's not, you know, when ranked up against all the other offerings, whether it's ETV, whether it's DSTV or any streaming service, you know, maybe, you know, we are looking at this one song of public broadcasting, at least in the format we know it at the moment.
So my final question to you, Gabriel, is considering what Terence said then, that public broadcasting may be something of a past age, that's kind of technology and society is now sort of making more difficult. Do you think that we should open up the airwaves, grant a lot more licenses, and let 1,000 flowers of media entertainment bloom across the airwaves and the channels?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think to an extent it must be done. Part of the thing to consider is what Terence mentioned about bandwidth. You know, in South Africa, internet penetration is, you know, high by African standards. It's recently been advertised at the investment conference, but it's only sitting at around 55%. So most people really are stuck with radio and TV. And then the SABC remains the only game in town for them, effectively. So I think that part of what matters about this is that it means that the SABC's producers, editorial teams, and journalists have the ability to clearly or in a warped fashion represent the news of the day as well as deliver quality entertainment. And that makes a really big difference. And I think part of the government's dilemma here, or the shareholders' dilemma here, is that if it retrenches staff and is therefore seen to be less popular, then it can not rely, or it might not find itself able to rely on the SABC to take the ANC's side so readily. Alternatively, if they keep all the staff, where are they going to find the money? So, yeah, no, it's a very tricky situation. In terms of opening up bandwidth, that's a no-brainer. It's a must-do. In terms of issuing greater allowances for people to use, for private companies to compete for not just internet bandwidth, but radio and television streaming as well, in the analog fashion. Yeah, absolutely. Let 1,000 flowers bloom. Let competition do its work to serve the public. But don't forget that insofar as the government does, insofar as the ANC does think of the SABC as its mouthpiece, a very difficult situation where you start telling your mouthpiece that you want to fire its staff. Very, very, very difficult. I would not be surprised if the retrenchments are withdrawn and the money's taken away from, you know, some essential service like the police or grants or you know, wherever the Treasury can find it.
Oh, well, it sucks to be us, I guess. Right, let's move on to the next story for today, which is that a taxi organization known as the National Taxi Alliance is holding a massive strike today across Gauteng and has been blocking traffic across many sections of Gauteng's roadways, particularly between Johannesburg and Pretoria and Midrand. They jammed up traffic by driving slowly on the N1 highway. They also have affected New Road and Allendale Road. There's been some media reports that some of the taxi protesters may possibly have been involved in vandalizing buses and cars and setting some of those alight, although you know, that remains to be seen. JMPD's Wayne Minar says the protest was legal. And that they are on the scene to kind of ease congestion as much as possible. The taxi drivers are making their way to the union buildings where they will be handing over a memorandum to the presidency. They want the government to explain why they say COVID-19 relief that was promised to the industry has not yet materialized. There were reports also of motorists being intimidated and commuters being pushed out of buses. Gauteng Education MEC Panyaza Lesufi said that matrics affected by the strike could write their exams at any school near to them and could arrive up to an hour late due to the taxi strike. Terence, what should we make of the taxi's demands and this COVID relief fund that's been promised?
I find the taxi industry a fascinating case study what is in a sense a uniquely South African business. It's a critical part of the functioning of the economy because it allows so many millions of people to get to their destinations. It's fairly organized, but it's also it also functions that in that informal stretch of the economy. Cash business. There's a lot of issues with tax compliance. The kind of thing the government would love to formalize, but I think there would be a tooth and nail battle against this. And this is sort of where the COVID relief comes in. Well, if you want to sort of exist on that periphery, but you want help at the same time, two things don't line up very well. As a business, it's very competitive, and there is a very unfortunate fringe of aggression that exists there. So I'm not surprised that there are people who report being intimidated. But this is really more emblematic of what does this industry want for itself. Does it want to be part of the formal sector with the responsibilities and perhaps the benefits that implies, or does it want to remain a sort of informal, semi-formalized organization that is able to dodge some of those costs and responsibilities? I think at the moment it's a case of having your cake and wanting to eat it.
Indeed. I think, as someone who's a big fan of free markets, it's very heartbreaking to see an industry sort of go this way. As Terence said, it's really important for South Africa, and in a lot of ways has allowed us to get away with not having great public transport because it carries so many very poor people to their destinations. But the industry seems to be dominated by gangsterism. It's taken over, it often fights and suppresses competition through violence. There's a lot of bad stuff going on. Gabriel, what do you make of the protests, the COVID relief, and really the what I just said about the taxi industry?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really good example of a quid pro quo that could have solved a huge problem, a silver lining that could have emerged through COVID. Had taxis stuck with 50% capacity when that had been mandated, and in exchange been granted serious relief, and in exchange allowed themselves to be, this would also have done very well if it had gone along with a full digitization of the social grants payment system, which would be synced up with a digital way to pay taxis. I mean, the way really to deal with the tax issue is to strongly incentivize taxis to get away from cash payments and into electric payments, electronic digital payments, and for very poor people to be able to do that. Most poor people who work, not all, but most have a bank account if they're working in the formal economy, even if they're earning minimum wage. And those who don't and are getting social grants, if that was attached to a digital wallet, then they could use that to pay for taxi fares as well. And, this great private enterprise could have worked hand in glove with the government to solve two problems and set up a sort of property rights system going forward, which would, I think, strongly disincentivize from competition through violence, would strongly incentivize competition through outperforming on safety, on space, on comfort in the journey. And I've got to say, I've didn't have a car for a while, and I used to take taxis to work and to get around, minibus taxis, in Pretoria, in Johannesburg, and in Cape Town, and in Pietermaritzburg. And I had completely different experiences in those cities. And you can guess which was the most pleasant and which was the least pleasant, based basically upon the extent to which those taxi businesses were being regulated. So I think it's an industry that really needs to do well for this country to do well. And yeah, that quid pro quo was not met, basically because the taxi bosses were willing to say, we don't want to stick to 50% occupancy. The government said, we'll push it up to 80%. Taxi bosses effectively said, we're going to drive it up to 100%. And there was no police that was going to stop them, because they were already effectively a mob because they're informal, right? So even if it's in a very polite sense, they're informal. It means they're outside of the state's monopoly on legitimate force and its ability to tax and spend. And so that's what you get. It's, I must say, in terms of strikes, I think this one probably irritated millions of people, or at least hundreds of thousands. And it's not the first one this year. Even before COVID, we had a couple. I am, to some extent, more concerned about what's likely to happen at Brackenfell High School on Friday, where the EFF promises to go and disrupt the matric's ability to write their exams because of a story about a private party where black people and colored people and white students were definitely invited, but apparently only a few of the white students accepted the invitation, and that's got the EFF very furious, and those matric's might not be able to write their exams as a result. That's a very tight case in point of disrupting a very important social function. But yes, Panyaza Lesufi has sort of said the same thing to less of an extent is happening with these strikes, and is trying to make allowances for the matrix to do it at different venues. And of course, that also brings further doubt upon the whole process. ENCA reported that one of the matric exam papers has been leaked.
Yeah, the Maths 2 paper.
So that's not great. So again, as we were saying with the SABC, so too with this, is that it's just every problem is, you know, just one octopus leg on a very, very many-legged octopus of problems.
I like that. Yes, it would be greatest calamari dish of all time. Octopus calamari. All right, let's move on.
I think we can guess what Gabriel's favorite Bond film was then.
Yes, probably.
I won't say.
Let's go on to our next topic today, which is, Terence, you've recently written about mining and empowerment policy in the mining industry. Of course, mining is an industry which, you know, for many years has been the bedrock of South Africa's economy. That's, you know, much less so in the modern era. But it's still quite an important place for where we could develop industry and provide jobs for a lot of people. Terence, what did you write about, and what's going on in mining?
Well, I think it's interesting to look at what I wrote that was published last week in relation to what's happening this week, which is the South Africa Investment Conference. The prompt for my piece was the junior mining in Durban, which for those who don't know, mining juniors are usually small firms that do exploration, that open up the new mines, if you like. They're the hopefully the companies of the future. And Minister Montashe, who I understand actually has a fairly good rapport with the industry, in contrast to some of his predecessors, went off script from when addressing this, and turned and attacked Sibanye Stillwater and its CEO Neil Froneman quite personally, saying they stole their rating in terms of BEE compliance. Now, what this has to do with is a long running problem in the mining industry that allows firms that have gone through empowerment deals, which have brought their shareholding up to a particular level, but where their empowerment partners exit, to still count those empowerment deals. In a sense, it's the once empowered, always empowered situation. The sequence of events was that there was a BEE deal done with Goldfields, and then Goldfields was bought by Sibanye-Stillwater, and it counts that previous deal as part of its empowerment credentials. Why is this important? Well, in 2018, this whole issue about being once empowered, always empowered went to court, and I think it's a particularly important and a potentially industry-ending issue. If firms are expected to constantly, conduct equity deals to maintain a certain degree of shareholding by empowerment entities, and when the charters say that this can be elevated, in the future, and everything's sort of always up for negotiation, it makes mining a somewhat uninvestable industry, or one that only the brave will touch. Now, Neil Froneman is one of the very few executives in South Africa who's been willing to call this out. I think he's very much the kind of industry leader we need. He's very much committed to the country, and he's not willing to tell the government where he thinks they should get off. What we've seen is that mining has been in deep trouble for decades. It was the bedrock of our economy. It's not so much the case anymore, in part because the economy has evolved, but also because South Africa, in contrast to other mining nations like Australia and Canada, was not able to take advantage optimally of the commodities boom. Our receipts went up, but our production, in many ways kind of held steady, whereas a country like Australia was able to leverage that to the full. We're not seeing much exploration here. It's around 10%. The global average is around 10% of capital expenditure in mining. In South Africa, it's about 2% in exploration. So we're not creating the next generation of miners. Now, South Africa still has troves of minerals worth trillions of rands. But often this is not easily accessible. It takes new technologies. It's looking at a very different industry. And if we are going to throw up all sorts of regulatory and empowerment hurdles, that's simply something that we are going to lose.
Dude, it seems as though the world keeps sort of throwing our mining industry opportunities to recover. I think now China is looking at banning Australian coal imports as a way of sort of enacting economic war against Australia for being anti-China. And that, of course, would presumably open up a great opportunity for our mining industry to then sort of fill the gap. But we don't seem to be making progress on that. Gabriel, how do you see things in the mining industry? Anything to add to Terence?
Yeah, again, I suppose sticking to my metaphor of one octopus leg on a many, many legged octopus of problems, gross fixed capital formation is something that we've been sort of talking about within the Institute this week. Some numbers have come out. Again, it's down. Obviously, it's very badly down during 2020 because of the lockdown here and worldwide. But if you look, when it peaked, it basically peaked in 2008. And since then has gone on a slow 20% decline in real terms. So we're not building new tools. And I think when you look at the joblessness rate in South Africa, which most people will agree is issue number one, front and center. We've already lost 2 million jobs this year. We already have one of the sort of world's highest recorded joblessness rates. We need more people to get to work. And for that, you need tools. There's this sort of weird idea that capital is the enemy. But like, if you want to do a job, you need a tool. You and I, all three of us, we need our microphones, we need our headphones, we need our laptops, we need our Wi-Fi. Those are the tools we need for our trade. I'm looking through the window at two farmers drilling a trench. They need their tools for their trade. A wheelbarrow is a tool. And if you want to do mining, you need shafts, you need explosions, you need wheels that can carry heavy loads up vertically a kilometer. You need all kinds of tools. Without which the project is completely pointless. And I am. Am I? Did I cut out? Oh, no. I'm definitely here.
Sorry, yes, I fell off the call there. Apologies. All right.
No worries.
Are you finished your point?
The conclusion of my point is that we really need to be encouraging people with the tools called money to turn those tools into fixed investments, real investments at the most competitive rate. And yeah, what Terence alluded to is a very harsh case in point of how we are not doing that, of how we're chasing the tools away. And so we lose more jobs, and it's very sad.
Indeed. Indeed. So anyway, hopefully we are able to turn that around in the not too distant future, as it will probably be a big part of the early stages of rebuilding South Africa's economy from years of misrule. Right, that's about all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to support the IRR, please go to our website, irr.org.za, click the Join Us button, become a friend of the Institute.